Welcome to the Experts in Sport podcast, brought to you by the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences at Loughborough University.
So today we're with Verity Postlethwaite, Amy Finch and Ruth Hollis, and we're here to talk about Spirit of 2012. We talk about whether a major event can be a catalyst for societal change, reflecting on the role of Spirit of 2012 and events in the UK since the London 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games. Hi everyone, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Hi.
Hi.
And what we often do, so before we start discussing events and legacy, we often start with an introduction. So please can you provide us with an introduction to yourselves and your connection to the Spirit of 2012? So can we start with Verity, please?
Thanks, Martin. Hello, everyone. It is great to be here. My name is Verity Postlethwaite, and I am a Vice Chancellor Independent Research Fellow in the School of Sport, Exercise and Sciences at Loughborough University. My research focuses on events across a number of different contexts and places and how they attempt to influence and have influenced broader societal debates. So that's how I originally became connected with the work of Spirit of 2012, as I stumbled across them during my doctoral project, which looked at the Inspire Generation legacy aim from the London 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games. Since then, I've begun to work directly with some of the communities, both funded by Spirit of 2012 and 2012 themselves. And I'm really beginning to understand the extent to which Spirit have influenced and created a really vibrant network connected to events and the impacts of events across the UK. So I'll talk a little bit more about that across the podcast. But we recently hosted or co-hosted a summit at Loughborough University that brought together around 100 different voices that were connected either to Loughborough or Spirit of 2012. And it was just such an enjoyable couple of days. And I had the pleasure of hosting Ruth and Amy and a couple of other colleagues across those 2 days. So I'm very excited for this podcast today.
Thanks, Verity. And yeah, we're going to touch upon all of those things throughout the podcast. So thanks a lot. Amy, can you just introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, hi everyone. My name is Amy Finch. I am Director of Policy and Impact at Spirit of 2012. And I've been with Spirit since 2017, where I initially joined to look after our learning function ahead of our first big independent evaluation report. And since then, so 7 years, I've been involved in so many different projects that Spirit has done. And about a year ago, 2 years ago, started looking more at our policy and influencing and how we can get all of the insights that we've learned into the right spaces to ensure that events can leave a longer social impact.
Thanks, Amy. We're looking forward to talking about that, the policy and influencing later on. And Ruth, what about yourself?
Hi, so I'm Ruth Hollis. I have the very great honour of being Chief Executive of Spirit of 2012. I've actually been with Spirit since the very beginning. I was working in the civil service in 2012 and the National Lottery Community Fund, big as they were then, decided that they wanted to endow an organisation to continue what they called the pride and positivity that they thought people felt in that summer, not just from the Olympics, but we also had a Jubilee, remember, and it was a very exciting summer to be in the UK. So I transferred across from the civil service at that point to set the charity up and could never quite leave, because I think the work we've been doing over the past 10, 11 years around events, commemorations, celebrations, both at national and community level, has really taught us a lot about how we use events, but also has been enormous fun, actually, to be involved in.
And I'm genuinely excited about talking about this, because I was in Australia, lived in Australia for a few years and came back in 2011, and then had the summer of 2012 was absolutely amazing. And I know not everybody thinks 2012 was absolutely amazing, you know, but the experience that many people had, and like you just said, the feeling that people had during that time was brilliant. So I'm really keen to hear about how you've attempted to and successfully with projects achieve that across you know, all these projects that I've seen on your website. So yeah, really looking forward to talk to you all. For our audience though, Ruth, can you just add some information for us around, you know, how was the Spirit of 2012 formed and why was it formed and what was its purpose?
Okay. So going back to 2012, all of the National Lottery distributors contributed money to the games and the games being delivered. And the kind of, I guess, the community element of it. So our funding came from the Big Lottery Fund, which is the part of the National Lottery that focuses its funds on communities in need. On it doesn't do elite sport. It doesn't really do lots of you know, like UK Sport are there for the elite sport. Sport England deliver sport. Arts Council deliver art. The Big Lottery Fund is really focused on communities and the kind of bits in between. And I think Peter Ainsworth, late chair of the National Lottery Community Fund, saw something in that summer and the way people responded to that mega event that for him focused his mind on communities and how communities respond to events and come together and feel more proud and more positive, and the impact on people in their place, not just in that very special part of East London. So we were endowed as an independent trust, which means we had a longer time to spend the money. We were very generously given £47 million at the end of 2013 to spend over a 10, but now 13 year period, because we've extended a bit beyond our original kind of scope because of the pandemic and other things. But what they said to us was, and the way the organisation was formed, was not actually to just fund some of the initiatives that had been great in 2012. And it would have been very easy to do that. We actually could have spent all of that money just continuing some of the activities that had been set in train that summer. But looking at actually how we could use those funds to take the learning from London, what we thought we knew about how people felt, into future events. So over the last 10 years, we've worked with both of the Commonwealth Games that have been hosted in the UK, both of the Cities of Culture that have been hosted during our time, but also commemorations like the Centenary of Women's Suffrage, Windrush last year, to really try and get under the skin of both how events can be used as a policy intervention and how some of those mechanisms used in event legacy, so sport and physical activity, arts and culture, volunteering, can be used to benefit the communities.
It's really interesting to hear that, the distinction between what could have been offered, I suppose, to go, let's just all do more sports, sport's amazing. And I'm sure we all would agree with that statement, but it's that wider value that this is digging into, and that wider community, and how sport can be that catalyst for change. So that's really interesting and really lines me up nicely for kind of a first question around what kind of factors or what kind of things from these events kind of provide opportunities for that societal change. So Amy, could you come in there and just kind of touch upon that, please?
Yeah, I mean, I think you do have to start with the event itself and making sure that is as amazing and spectacular and memory forming as it can be. So, you know, the events that are that offer that kind of spectacular do seem to ignite that spark, which then the community and outcomes can build on. And then I think it's about a strategic vision for what that event can achieve and trying not to pile too much in. Try to be laser focused on, okay, it could achieve many, many outcomes. What do we really want and what does our place need? So having that kind of strategic vision, which is co-designed with the area, basically. And then events bring partnerships like almost nothing else. So they really have that opportunity to switch on other parts of, whether it's the local authority, whether it's business, to the power of arts and culture, volunteering and sport. So you can bring in new people that realise how amazing events are, and those partnerships can outlast the event. And then I think this focus on who is included and who is left out. So we've done a lot of work around inclusion of all different types, particularly because of our legacy in the Paralympic Games on disability inclusion. So really thinking about how the event can be a catalyst for greater inclusion across that place in those different types of activities. And then I think finally, I would say events do have a really big evaluation budget and generate a lot of learning and insights, and making sure that is not only exists after the event, but is relevant and used by other parties, not just event organisers. I do think is a massive responsibility. Not everywhere has the chance to reflect on that kind of scale. So making that available.
I think that's really interesting. There's a couple of kind of follow-up questions, I suppose, from there around when we talk societal change. We're obviously talking about a national event here, and you've mentioned kind of East London right at the start. Was this targeted at societal change everywhere? Was it specifically East London? Was there any focus on different groups and population? I know you mentioned disability there. So where does all that sit? Sorry. You know, interviewer, don't ask lots of questions in one, and I've just done it. So over to you guys, untangle that if you can.
I mean, in terms of the London Games, there was a societal element to it, most of which was around sport and physical activity. So you'll remember there was a big headline figure, 1 million people more active as a result of the London Games. I think there are debates every year, seemingly there seems to be a new number about whether we've hit that or not. I think part of the discourse that we've been trying to have with events is trying not to focus on those big totemic numbers when they're bidding, because they do just tie your hands. I mean, when we had the 10th anniversary of the Games year before, people wanted to talk about the stadium, they wanted to talk about East London, but they also wanted to, you know, people love to talk about big ticket targets that have been missed, right? The media are always interested in that. Actually, what we think the focus should be on is engaging the least active, like using the event as an excuse to really target the people who are furthest from participation. So that's where we've been trying to kind of steer the agenda on societal impacts from events away from just trying to hit a kind of big ticket number into some really tangible changes for people.
I'm so pleased you said that, and you paused a little bit when you talked about the 1 million people more active. I'm not sure if I've shared this or if I should share this, but back after the Olympics, I was the head of sport in a further and higher education college, and the legacy makers came in to the college and they did a big session with the students, and they said, we're going to make 1 million people more active, and we're going to log it on this computer system. And, you know, you guys are all now legacy makers. You've done this, you know, whatever it was, 4-hour course. And what you need to do is log 10 hours of physical activity on this website. And if you do that, you get this free, lovely Adidas polo t-shirt. And the astute students in my college at the time, hands up, is anybody checking this? No. So if I just go on now and log 10 hours of physical activity, do I get that free Adidas t-shirt? And the guy at the front was like, yes. And they all just went straight away, wrote down 10 hours, got a free t-shirt, so that they could say there was 1 million hours. And I was just like, no, this is not what it should be about. But I can see why these numbers are there, and I can see why that happened. So that's why I've only told that story, which will go out to people on this podcast, because of what you said, we don't necessarily need those numbers that actually are quite, whether we say fake or not, whatever we want to say about that. And that's not me saying it didn't inspire a generation or didn't do this debate or all over that. What I really liked about your answer was two things. One was from Amy as well, around the evaluation insights and learnings and where we can cross this over into other things. And, you know, everybody talks about collaboration and working together. This genuinely sounds like something where you have worked with multiple communities. You've worked with those diverse communities, those disadvantaged communities, to whether it be inspire them or assist them or help them into getting to where you want to be with physical activity. I think it, for me, having been around a lot of this, it sounds really refreshing of what you guys have achieved. So moving on from that, what are you guys really proud of? In this, you've been working there for since it started, or for the last five, six, 7 years. What are you guys most proud of in what you've achieved with Spirit of 2012?
It's quite hard, really, isn't it? Because it's like children and pets. You're never really meant to kind of pick a favourite. So I'm not going to pick a favourite project. I think what I'm most proud of is the way that Spirit has been able to convene people from different sectors with the inspiration of an event to move on work that really shouldn't be sectorally focused, but should be across. So one of the real powers of events is that it brings together not just sport and physical activity, but also arts and culture. There's normally a kind of wraparound cultural event, particularly with a big event, and volunteering. And it's an excuse to look at things like inclusion, particularly around disability inclusion, but other areas. So I think the power of the London 2012 brand, which we still use, and the power of that event in convening allows us to bring people together from different worlds to have conversations that I don't think are happening elsewhere.
Nice. I like it. I mean, that touches on what I really picked up straight away from you, that actually bringing people together is just an opportunity to do that. And it seems like you're doing it very, very well. Amy, what about yourself? What are you most proud of?
Yeah, well, I think it was our 10th birthday in November, and we had a lovely birthday party with grantees and staff from past and present. And I was actually really proud that loads of ex-staff and ex-projects did come, and it felt awesome. And I think, you know, we said you're not going to pick a favourite project, but we have funded over 200 projects. So many of them were able to talk about lasting impact of that work, how that had changed their organisations, or how they were able to continue approaches that they'd started, how they'd had the freedom within the grant to think differently. And so I felt like it was a really good testament to the approach we're suggesting that large events take. You could see how that was happening in the individual projects for those organisations. So I felt quite proud about that.
And without mentioning any names or favourite pets or children, can you give us some more specific examples of some of those projects that specifically, you know, did achieve their objectives?
Yeah, I mean, I think an example, we had 10 projects that were working in the pandemic around thinking about carers' access to music. For some of those, that was carers' organisations who hadn't been switched on to how arts and culture could be offer improvements to wellbeing for their participants. For some of them, that was music projects that hadn't had the time to think in depth about the specific barriers that carers might have for their projects. So and those on both counts have kind of continued. So that was awesome. We have had a really large project that's been about 20% of our endowment called Get Out, Get Active, which has been run by the Activity Alliance. That's worked across the UK to support disabled and non-disabled people to work, to be physically active together. So things like not having, you know, you have two children, one is disabled, one is not disabled, and they have to go to different sports activities on a weekend, and you're, as a parent, you're ferrying between them. What GOGA has been trying to do is think, okay, why not offer the children to be active as a family together? In other places, it's been looking at other areas, and it's been successful at getting the least active into physical activity and maintaining that activity over time.
And actually, that programme we started in the run-up to Rio. So we knew there were questions about the million more active for London. We knew we wanted to get away from that sense of just hitting a big physical activity target, because what the 1 million does, you know, to come back to your anecdote, is it will often just inspire the people that would have been inspired already, right? The people that would have done physical activity, they might try something different, but they're more likely to be engaged. We knew we wanted to do something quite different, and we knew that Rio coming along, even though it was a Games in a, you know, completely different place and time zone, gave us the opportunity to do that. So when we went out to talk to stakeholders, what they said to us is, actually, there's lots of supply, both on the disability sport and mainstream sport side. Supply isn't an issue. The issue is how things are actually delivered to enable people to be active together, and how the projects really go out to reach those people who are inactive, who are not just, you know, under 30 minutes physical activity in, you know, Chief Medical Officer's guidance, but the furthest from physical activity. We've been able to fund that over the last 7.5 years. We've been joined by Sport England and the London Marathon Trust in funding it, because that stuff takes time. Really engaging the least active takes time. It takes commitment. It takes showing people that they can do it, that it is for them, that the space is accessible, that there will be alterations made, that there is a social element so people make friends. And what I'm really proud of on that programme is they've got really good data on people's sustained physical activity after 6 months on the programme. So it isn't just who's turning up, but actually they've got statistically significant data on who is remaining physically active from that group.
That's brilliant. And it's, as I would imagine, it's not just the physical activity. You know, you've got your social, you've got your psychological side of it. And also, to an extent, even if people do drop away from the physical side, they might have built social connections and gained psychological advantage. Even if you've not getting the data of physical, there's going to be added things that we all know exist but don't hit that million number. There's still that positivity from it. So there's some great examples that you've given us there. Now, we all know success is what a lot of people talk about, but I think in the spirit of what you mentioned around evaluation and providing insights to everybody to develop, could you touch upon the biggest challenges and kind of opportunities that you've had over the past decade in this space? Because I'm sure you've come across many challenges.
Yeah, I actually think one of the things relates back to, again, your anecdote and this tension of both case making for events and being a critical friend and wanting them to improve and seeing the missed opportunities. And that's been a kind of positioning thing for us throughout our lifetime, that we know how many amazing wellbeing and social connection and inclusion benefits there can be, but then don't pretend that they're always happening and they're always happening for everyone. So I think getting that right has been a challenge, and linked to that, sharing really openly about not what hasn't gone right is a challenge as a funder, when the challenges that you're sharing are not necessarily your own or the ones that you're directly delivering. So how to both convince grant holders that we genuinely mean it when they can try things that don't work and that's not going to risk their grant and that kind of thing. And then if you have that, how then to share openly those learnings so they don't affect their kind of chances of funding in the future with other funders. So I think that is a big challenge, and one that we're continuously trying to improve on.
How have you attempted to do that? Because the generation of that trust from you funding a project and them going, oh, we've said we're going to do this and we've not done it. Oh no, let's just tell them we've done it. You know, how have you tried to build that trust where they actually do go, do you know what? They're going to support us no matter what. And and that can continue down the chain often, in my experience, that you're funding somebody who's actually helping a project that somebody else might be leading, but they're managing. And how does that relationship kind of help, or how have you been able to build that trust in certain scenarios?
Yeah, I mean, I think our grant managers have managed quite a small number of grants each, with a chance to build genuine relationships rather than have those just mediated by a report. And we've had a big emphasis on all staff, not just grant managers, and board members going out and visiting and being able to see the work for themselves, to be able to understand that it's challenging to put everything within the structure of a report. I think some of those relationships have worked really, really well. And at the application stage, you can kind of get a sense for curiosity and willingness to learn and willingness to be vulnerable, I guess. but it is challenging. And I think actually the difficulties of the charity sector over the last couple of years have probably made that more challenging, and that some charities are probably more risk averse at the moment because funding is so hard to come by.
I think one of the other challenges is around the very high expectations that we set for events and not wanting to be seen to fail or bring out any of the kind of negatives. I think it's quite high. It's made even more difficult in an environment where, when you're talking about the very biggest events, an organising committee is set up with a responsibility both for legacy and the event. They naturally get to a point in the delivery cycle where legacy has to take a back seat because what they're focused on is delivering a safe and successful event. They then close post-event and transfer the responsibility of legacy to somebody else, or it gets scattered. Often it doesn't have associated budget with it. And all of these things are things that we pointed out in our 2021 inquiry into the power of events, about how we could do legacy better. But then in that structure, the opportunity to be reflective, to really think about the lessons, to really hand the baton onto the next event to say that these are the things that, you know, you really need to watch is quite difficult. And I think there is a commitment to doing it and a commitment to being open, but it is hard for people when what they might be perceived to have not done well may come under lots of scrutiny, particularly in those big ticket events.
That's interesting you mentioned, because I think we will move on shortly to looking at the inquiries and the evaluations that you've done, and also the passing on of the baton and any advice that you might need to give. I think it's also interesting to think about and talk about, you know, you're mentioning change for those who are in the most deprived places or the least physically active. And to be able to do that is a whole nother level than ticking a box to say a million people have done more things. And I think those areas are very, very difficult to evaluate. You know, if you're specifically focused on evaluating impact of physical activity at those levels, very, very difficult. I mean, you see things all the time, and you may have done kind of your financial evaluations. And I think things I've read are like, for every pound spent on this, it's £4 worth of social value or £7 worth of social value, which are good evaluations and certainly worthwhile. But the deeper things and the deeper knowledge that you're gaining from this, especially as Amy mentioned, developing those personal relationships in those communities. And I do wonder how much some of your work is fed into the kind of place-based stuff that everybody's now talking about. And you know, I'm sure from this conversation, I'm thinking you guys must have had a part to play in that, because there's a lot of charities and Sport England and many now are talking, you know, we really need to go place-based. We really need to be looking at qualitative research into really understanding, building trust, building relationships to make these changes happen across society. And interestingly, you mentioned art and culture a number of times, actually. And at London 2012, the things that I remember, obviously we all remember Mo Farah, and we all remember, you know, the Super Sunday, Super Saturday. Why has that gone out of my head? You know, all those gold medals that we won. I was actually at Blur in Hyde Park. I didn't get a ticket for any of the Olympics, but I was at, I did. That's a longer story. I went to the horse. I was at an equine college, and I didn't know what dressage was. And I watched the first bit of dressage. I went, oh, that was nice. And then I watched the second one. And then I watched the third one. I was like, they're all doing the same thing. And then the equine department laughed at me and said, that's what they do. I had no idea. It's a very nice event, but it wasn't my thing. So I did go. But more to the point, I remember the Blur concert. I remember the art and the culture just as much as I remember Mo Farah winning gold and things like that. So it has got such broader things to look at than those numbers that we all automatically go to.
We did some polling. We did some polling in 2022 on the 10th anniversary, and 65% of the people we polled across the UK told us they thought there was still a legacy, still a lasting impact of London 2012, and that was 75% in London. Now, these are not people on organised legacy programmes, because there just aren't enough of them around. These are people that remember that summer. We, you know, for a long time on our risk register after 2012 had a risk that the name would become obsolete, that we would have to change it, we would have to rebrand, because it would feel a bit kind of, you know, icky to kind of look back and a bit... bit backward focused. Actually, whenever we've gone out to talk to people, they want to talk to us about their memories of that summer. And it isn't the tangible stuff. It, as you say, it isn't people that were there on Super Saturday. It's people that went to the torch relay, that went to the big old bouncy castle that Jeremy Della did, that saw the gold post boxes in their communities, and tapping into that sense of pride in place, that places can deliver, that the UK can deliver spectacular things, is something that we can't ignore when we're planning events, because that does have an impact. Now, if you then combine that with very detailed place-based work to engage people that might not otherwise be engaged, that's, I think, where you kind of hit gold.
I think that two sides of the coin is really, really important, though, that those moments of national significance or significance for that region or city where it feels really widespread and there's many people involved having a collective shared experience with the thought about that deep work and where there needs to be greater support, longer term activities. You do need both, or that's what events can give you. Events can give you the both.
Definitely. And I think we'll talk about it a little bit later on. But we all know that at the moment, there's a lot of people pulling out of having major events in their countries and things like that. And, you know, I've seen different evaluations around 2012 of financially, was it worth it and all this kind of thing. And you talk to somebody who's biased, but every time I speak to anyone about 2012, it brings a smile to my face. I can smell smells from then. That sounds stupid, doesn't it? But I genuinely cannot. I feel myself back in that field on Super Saturday with Blur concert and, you know, with my wife and brother. And I can remember it all. And, it just brings a smile to my face. So for me, that's what 2012 was for me. It was that community. Yeah, the success was great, but all that. But it was everybody being happy and talking, and you guys being able to kind of keep that legacy going in local projects. Yeah, I think it's absolutely, absolutely amazing. With that said, I'm going to bring Verity in because she's been very quiet over there. And I just wanted to mention to you, obviously, we're talking about societal change, which we know is very difficult to achieve. And we're talking about using a sporting event to do that. But should every event like this be attempting to make societal change?
I had a pre-written answer to this, but having listened to all three of you offer some personal reflections and some of these incredible insights, it's now hard to just speak out loud and say what I originally was going to think. To sort of bring in some of the points that Ruth and Amy have mentioned is just to remind people listening that the journey of hosting the London 2012 Games, which triggered Spirit of 2012, started in the late 1990s, early 2000s. So if we just think about how much time has passed and how society, policy contexts, have all changed and morphed, have been hit by very positive, very negative things. It's really important to see that sort of messiness of the journey of an event. And traditionally, you would place an event and the 2 or 3 weeks of the event as being what is the most important time. But what research is showing, and in particular the aspects of the research I look at, is that it's the 5-10 years before the event happens that are the most important for some of these longer term benefits and some of these conversations that Ruth and Amy have tried to sort of bring together. And that simply boils down to that an event doesn't happen in a vacuum, and that an event isn't for an event's sake. It's not just about the things happening on the pitch or in the gallery or on the stage or as part of like a Jubilee celebration and the multiple street parties that are happening. You have to think about the costs. You have to think about who's been included. You have to think about these longer term benefits with a critical eye in a big time period before the event is hosted. So I think what Spirit of 2012 continue to sort of bang on the drum with their fundies and the people that they're now trying to influence with the evidence that have been gathered is that these difficult conversations about who benefits and how they will benefit from an event that will happen in 5 years' time need to be happening now. And legacy and sustainability and long-term impacts have to be embedded from the start of an event plan, an event bid. And London 2012 was a trial of that. So from a technical perspective, the London 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games were the first to systematically build the term legacy into the event. Now, academics, as Ruth has implied, more broadly, there is a lot of contestation around what legacy means, whether it's been positive, negative, intangible, tangible. We could go on for hours about that. But I think just to bring it back to what I'm learning from Spirit of 2012 and how the collaborations that Loughborough University have with the organisation is about understanding the convening power of an organisation such as Spirit or an organising committee to really crystallise those partnerships at that organisational level so that more communities can benefit and we can understand why and how those communities are benefiting. And the thing that I think crystallises the most is that Spirit has very clearly had a remit of investing in happiness, which can mean many things to many people, but very cleverly, there are really clear outcomes underpinning that around well-being and the changing perceptions of disability and improving social cohesion. And that shared sense of outcomes, not the shared sense of the event and owning an event, but the shared sense of building towards an outcome, is what I truly believe Spirit has both challenged and also provided a safe space for people in the event sector to play around with that and understand how you can use the convening power and event to build in systematically this legacy and impact piece. But it is a really challenging space, and bringing together sectors, convening people is really messy, very noisy. And I think we've still got a long way to go. But I'm super excited to understand how events can't just be seen as being in a vacuum and just being that 2 or 3 weeks. It is part of a much bigger time span, a much louder room. And listening to those voices is so, so important.
Thanks, Ferry. So you mentioned there as well that the partnership with Loughborough, and I know there's others. So I think you've kind of commissioned some final grant funding for strategic and learning partnerships, like we've mentioned, one with Loughborough. What, Ruth and Amy, what are your ambitions for these kind of ongoing projects, these future projects?
I think if I give you the kind of top level vision behind them, and then Amy can come in on the detail. What I knew I didn't want for Spirit was a final evaluation report that gave us a pat on the head, said, didn't they do well, and then sat on a website somewhere or in a drawer, never looked at again. We've had evaluations, we've done summative, formative process evaluations that looked at our practice, looked at our achievements, all of those things over the years, and they've been great. But the legacy for me is that the wealth of information we've got, the insights that we've gathered, the things that we've done with our partners, can have a use and a practical application when we're not here anymore. That they're out there in the field being used and being put together with other people's data and information and challenged. And sometimes, you know, people saying that it didn't amount to what we might have thought it did, but being that sort of critical friend in terms of the data and it being useful. So that's why we've gone down the legacy learning partner route. Amy can tell you more about some of the kind of detail of the ambition.
Yeah, so we've got a partnership with Belong, which is the Cohesion and Integration Network, and that's looking at social cohesion, essentially, and how events, community events, can bridge divides and bring people together. And your previous question about whether all events should be looking to achieve social legacy, well, obviously it's ridiculous to expect the same of community events as we do of these major events. But actually, some of those magic ingredients at the right scale proportionally that help towns and villages and mass community events like the Joe Cox Great Get Together, to think more about how is that event bridging divides in that community? What is its function within that community? I think is really, really exciting. In our inquiry report, we had a little section at the end of each bit for small event organisers and how the stuff that we're talking about can apply even at the smallest scale. So I'm really that's going to be really, really interesting. They're focused on creating a toolkit around that. Then we've got a partnership with Pro Bono Economics, which is looking at wellbeing, and that builds on work we've been doing over a number of years with the What Works Centre for Wellbeing as well, which is closing at the end of April. And that's kind of looking, those two projects together are looking at both case studies and the power of case studies to be able to tell a wellbeing story, and also cost effectiveness analysis, which you mentioned earlier, Martin, so applying a cost effectiveness lens to some of our work. And then we've got Loughborough. So I'll leave Verity to say a little bit more about it, but this is focusing mostly on our perceptions of disability outcome, and really challenging, what does that actually mean? How on earth do you measure it? And it's also working with a really exciting audience, because the product that is going to come out of it is young people and the youngest people, so early years. So it was so exciting with these commissions to actually just ask, what do people want? And maybe it wasn't what we expected. So our partners were, you know, it's not like a normal contracting where you've got a really clear idea in mind of the products, but you know enough about our evidence. What do you think it might be applied for? And Loughborough is probably, was the most original of our bids for sure. And we're still really interested in how it's going to kind of turn out.
I can see you smiling, Verity, and nodding. So Verity, you're going to have to come in and tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Martin. Thanks, Amy. Yeah, I'm so excited. I need to harness this excitement into putting my project management hat on and becoming a very serious researcher. But no, I think, just to reiterate what Amy said, when the tender process came out for the learning partnerships, I think it actually really nicely illustrates all of the points that Ruth and Amy have mentioned across this conversation about how Spirit have pushed people that want to engage with them to be a bit different, a bit original, a bit challenging, a bit risk-taking. And when I read the tender, I knew straight away there was an opportunity for Loughborough University to come together internally to offer something different to the Spirit of 2012. So the first really exciting thing about the project we pitched is that it didn't just sit within the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences. It needed and it craved input from some of our colleagues in the Digital Storytelling Academy, who come from more of an arts and humanities background, the School of Geography, and some of that place-based and placemaking aspects. And then our wonderfully vibrant, but often not collaborated with Loughborough London campus and the Institute of Sport Business and the Creative Arts. So what was really, really lovely when I was putting the bid together and bringing together this ultimate team to pitch to Spirit is that it pulled into the different expertise that Loughborough University has, which is umbrellaed by our strength and reputation around doing sport research, but also just some of the really interesting methodologies and voices we have around campuses. So as Amy alluded to, we are targeting the earliest years, and we're going to look at how the evidence and learnings from across Spirit of 2012's portfolio can be repurposed, translated, challenged, supported to produce content that looks at the earlier sector and how some of these early messages on what disability means to different people can be disrupted and stimulated to really build on changing these perceptions around disability and what that means. I'm going to put a big dot, 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 because I do not have all the answers to what will come out of the project, as we've committed to, and this was encouraged significantly by Spirit's own ethos, to truly co-producing and co-designing each step of the project. So as we're recording this podcast, we're currently putting together what that advisory group will look like and how we will even start to ask those first sets of questions, which is why we hosted the summit. So we asked people really basic questions. What does digital mean to everyone? How can you access digital? What are so already some inequalities in different spaces around digital? What does disability mean to people? We have the Peter Harrison Centre for Disability Sport at Loughborough. We have a lot of wealth of evidence, but it was really interesting to talk to some diverse voices about what disability means to them in 2024. And then we need to discuss with Spirit, and this is why I'm so excited that we could capture this today, to learn from Amy and Ruth about what their vision is for what a learning partnership looks like. As across the higher education landscape, funding is also becoming more and more scarce and more precious. And with the time and resource that we're putting into this project, we want to make sure that we understand what a learning partner is and how we can make sure that we fit with this vision that Ruth has about making sure that the evidence becomes practical and is put into the right hands and is given to the right people, the right communities, to just capitalise on the wealth of information that's been captured and hopefully put it to good use in the future. But I'm very aware that's a super lofty aspiration. So, Martin, perhaps let's do a podcast in about 18 months' time and figure out where we've got to.
you read my mind. I was certainly thinking there we've got another one lined up for the future. So thanks for the detail. Coming to you not so soon on a podcast, I think, definitely. We're quickly running out of time. And as aware, we were going to touch upon one of the inquiries that you did around the power of events and the report. But Ruth, you did mention you didn't want evaluations and they just sat on a website. We'll direct people to that website. I wanted to briefly mention that what jumped out to me when I looked at those recommendations you'd provided was, I think one of the statements was how events can build connected, happy and thriving communities. And that just really jumped out at me. And I thought that's a great statement and a great job to be involved in for yourselves, developing that. You know, that's amazing. So I think the final question for me before I conclude would be to both you, yourself, Ruth and Amy. What advice would you give to future event organisers?
I think the key thing is to build social impact in, not bolting it on. I think if the starting point of bidding for an event is coming from a place where you understand what change you want to deliver for the city or the place, and the event becomes a pivot point or, you know, can give rocket boosters to providing that change, you can have a really kind of, I think, more contextual and longer lasting discussion about legacy and what it means to people in those places. So I think start with the place, start with the why. You know, Simon Sinek says it all the time, but it isn't, we've talked a bit about places dropping out of hosting events because it is expensive. You know, events do need to show that they're worth it. And to do that, you have to start with the ambitions of a place and why you would do it in the first place. And then there's lots of kind of technical things in our report about making sure that there is a responsibility for legacy, there is funding for legacy, there isn't a cliff edge when the organising committee drops off, but you actually have local partnerships holding the responsibility for delivering those long-term impacts and that they have the funding to do it.
That's brilliant. I mean, we've touched upon so many things. It's been great speaking to you and hearing of the success that you have. What really jumps out to me is, it sounds like you've had great success along this project and you've worked with communities. And again, going back to the creating happiness really in communities is brilliant. And not just across sport and physical activity, but through creative arts and other methods to really forge communities together in whatever sense that might come and whatever they need. So that place-based and personal experience with them, that's what jumps out to me. But the other thing that jumps out to me is the learning that you've had from this and the future learning and the impact that what the work you've done at Spirit 2012 is going to have on others, or has probably already had on other people and will have in futures to come. So not only has London 2012 had this legacy, but it really does jumps out to me that Spirit of 2012 has had this huge legacy on other people at the current time, but with the learning and the partnerships that you've created is going to continue to have legacy, you know, long lasting legacy forever and realistically changing the way that we do things and changing the way events do things in the future. So it's been amazing to talk to you. We'll direct our audience to some of the work of your website, some of your evaluations and the toolkits and this, the inquiry of the power of events, so they can get there. And I'm sure that if anybody wants to speak to any of you, your contact details will be available there. And get in touch with me if you need to, but get in touch with Verity or Amy or Ruth, and I'm sure they'd love to chat and provide any information that you guys might want. But from me, thank you very much. It's been great talking to you. It's really brought that spirit of 2012 and the London 2012 game back to life. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Experts in Sport podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, then please contact me, Martin Foster, at m.foster@alborough.ac.uk. Thanks for listening. See you next time.